Hello and welcome back once again to Surgery 101, the app, website and podcast series brought to you with the help of the Department of Surgery at the University of Alberta. You can find out more about Surgery 101, including the Surgery 101 app, Surgery 101 notes, videos and all of our previous episodes at our new website, which is surgery101.org. This is episode 2 in our series on inflammatory bowel disease, and in this week's episode, Dr. Landa Bistrich is going to be talking about basic medical management of IBD. So she'll be considering how you choose the treatment and what the goals of therapy are, differentiating between induction and maintenance of remission. She'll be looking at the common classes of drugs, 5-ASAs, steroids and immunomodulators, and considering both their indications and the adverse effects that are commonly associated with them. So, let's get ready to dig deeper in week 2 of inflammatory bowel disease, here on Surgery 101.
Hi everyone, this is Lana Bistritz again from the Royal Alexandra Hospital in Edmonton. In our last session, we had discussed the diagnosis and presentation of inflammatory bowel disease, and in this section, we're going to talk about initial medical therapy of IBD. So the initial therapy of IBD is dictated based on, number one, the type of inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's versus ulcerative colitis. Number two, the location of disease involvement. So does this patient have isolated proctitis, or do they have pancolitis, or do they have small bowel involvement? The other important factor, factor number three to consider, is the severity of inflammation. So someone who has more severe disease, you may want to consider IV steroids as opposed to oral steroids, for example. So first, prior to initiating medical therapy, it's important to clearly establish the diagnosis. So even if you have a young patient who has had bloody diarrhea for the last 4 weeks, it's really not adequate to treat them with medication empirically before you have a true diagnosis. So if the patient is a new presentation, they need a tissue diagnosis prior to treatment. If the patient is a known case of inflammatory bowel disease, even if they're having symptoms compatible with a flare, it's important to rule out other causes. So this can be infection, and all of these patients should have stool samples done for culture as well as C. diff toxin during episodes of flares. As well, medications can cause a flare of IBD, most commonly NSAIDs, but also the 5-ASA drugs. And if these had been recently initiated, they should be stopped before escalating therapy. Patients with inflammatory bowel disease also may have coexistent irritable bowel syndrome, and so just because a patient is having some increased diarrhea or abdominal pain doesn't necessarily indicate increasing therapy. So in those patients, we often check their inflammatory markers, such as C-reactive protein, and sometimes we repeat endoscopic assessment or radiologic assessment to document true evidence of increased inflammation or gut involvement prior to escalating therapy. The first therapeutic modality I wanted to mention briefly are antibiotics. You will see that these are empirically used sometimes during flares for the theoretical benefit of reducing transmural inflammation, but really there is no good evidence for their use. Certainly they're indicated in someone who does have a septic complication such as abscess, and they are useful adjunctive therapy for perianal fistula, but there is no evidence for their use as independent therapy for a patient with inflammatory bowel disease, and I think this is something you're going to be seeing less and less in practice. Moving on, there are two goals of therapy in inflammatory bowel disease. One is inducing remission in a patient with active symptoms, and the other is maintaining remission in someone whose symptoms are now under control. So when we look first at induction of remission, let's talk about the 5-ASA or 5-aminosalicylate drugs first. So these are useful mainly in ulcerative colitis, and in fact, they're the mainstay of therapy from mild to moderate UC. The original drug in this class that was available was sulfasalazine. It was less well tolerated because of the sulfa moiety, so now the most common 5-ASA drug used is mesalamine. There are various formulations of mesalamine available, and based on their compounding, they are either time-released, released based on bacterial degradation in the colon, or released based on pH at different points in the gut. This enables them to be targeted at either the small intestine or the colon, and they can be selected based on these characteristics and applied to the patient's location of disease. So a patient who has limited proctitis involving the rectum can usually be treated with topical therapy with mesalamine suppositories at a dose of 1 gram per day, or mesalamine enemas at a dose of 2 to 4 grams daily. Improvement in these patients is usually seen within 2 weeks, and then they can be maintained on these medications as well. If the disease in ulcerative colitis extends from the rectum up to the splenic flexure, then this is usually too far to treat with just suppositories, but they can be treated with enemas as well, a mesalamine enema in a dose of 2 to 4 grams per day. If there's no improvement in these patients with left-sided disease, then oral 5-ASA can be added. In patients with more proximal ulcerative colitis, oral 5-ASA is the mainstay of therapy, and the dose can range from 2 to 4 grams per day for mild ulcerative colitis to 4.8 grams per day for someone with moderate severity. Initially, these medications were given in QID dosing, but that impacted adherence negatively, and now BID dosing has been shown to be equivalent, and there are some new formulations with once-daily dosing for the 5-ASAs, which significantly improve patient compliance. The remission rates in patients with ulcerative colitis taking 5-ASAs are in the range of about 50%, so half of your patients will see excellent symptom resolution. In addition, even with the patients who do have proximal involvement with their ulcerative colitis, rectal therapy can still give some additional symptomatic benefit because a lot of patients are most troubled by those distal symptoms that are related to proctitis, such as the urgency, the frequency, the tenesmus, and the bleeding. And for ulcerative colitis, if the 5-ASA drugs are useful for inducing a remission, they can also be used for subsequent maintenance. This is very different from the Crohn's scenario, where 5-ASAs have been shown to be no better than placebo for treatment of Crohn's disease, despite their use in practice. And again, most people are moving away from using 5-ASAs in the Crohn's population. The 5-ASA drugs are usually well tolerated, but obviously they do have some adverse effects. Sulfasalazine, which is used less often now, decreases folate absorption, so if you are using sulfasalazine, you do need to give the patient a folic acid supplement. Sulfasalazine causes reversible male infertility, and because of the sulfa moiety, can cause rash, nausea, and headache. The mesalamine products are a little bit better tolerated, although they still can cause some headache and diarrhea. And in fact, in some patients who have just started the 5-ASA drugs, you may see a worsening of colitis that could mimic a flare. More rare complications of mesalamine include drug-induced pancreatitis, interstitial nephritis, proteinuria, and interstitial pneumonitis. And so these patients should have a urinalysis and a serum creatinine performed on a 6 to 12 month basis when they're maintained on these medications. In a patient with ulcerative colitis that fails to respond to 5-ASA therapy or was severe at the outset and you needed urgent control, steroids are the next line of defense. So steroid enemas can be used for local disease, although the steroid enemas are not significantly more effective than 5-ASA enemas. Or for a patient who has a longer segment of disease, oral prednisone at 40 milligrams a day with a slow taper over 6 to 8 weeks would be the standard outpatient steroid regimen. IV steroids can be used initially if the patient has a more severe presentation or if they're not responding to oral prednisone. And usually the dose would be methylprednisolone 30 milligrams IV BID. The response to IV steroids should be assessed at 72 hours, and if there's no improvement in this patient with ulcerative colitis, then you need to start thinking of rescue therapy with either biologic therapy, cyclosporin, or surgery, which will be discussed in a later podcast. Steroids are effective to induce remission in ulcerative colitis as well as for Crohn's disease, but they're not effective for maintenance therapy and they have significant long-term adverse effects. For a patient with Crohn's disease, induction of remission with steroids is quite common. And again, this can be similar doses to the patient with ulcerative colitis, with oral prednisone for induction therapy or IV therapy if the patient has severe disease. The one distinguishing characteristic between Crohn's and ulcerative colitis when it comes to steroid therapy is that for patients with ileocecal disease, we do have available an enteric-coated preparation of budesonide. This is targeted specifically at the ileocecal area, so it can be useful for a patient with mild to moderate ileocolonic Crohn's. It has extensive first-pass metabolism, which reduces its systemic side effects, but there is still some risk of systemic effects, although less than with prednisone. And it is effective for induction at doses of 9 milligrams per day, but just as with systemic steroids, it is not effective maintenance therapy. Again, the steroid side effects cannot be underestimated. These include skin effects such as bruising, poor wound healing, acne, and moon face. Chronic use increases the risk of glaucoma and cataracts, and many patients will have psychiatric symptoms such as insomnia, labile mood, or even steroid-induced psychosis. If the patient is on chronic steroids, they have an increased risk of glucose intolerance, elevated triglycerides, weight gain, and adrenal suppression. Bone complications such as osteoporosis or avascular necrosis of the hip have been described in patients on steroids, and patients on steroids are at increased risk of infection. Overall, the more steroid exposure a patient with inflammatory bowel disease receives correlates with worse outcomes overall, so our goal in managing these patients is to minimize steroid exposure by controlling inflammation with other therapies. For many patients with Crohn's disease and patients with ulcerative colitis who fail to improve with 5-ASAs, immunomodulator therapy is the next step up. The first class are thiopurines, which include 6-mercaptopurine, and azathioprine, which is a prodrug metabolized to 6-MP, and these result in response rates of about 50 to 60% for both UC and Crohn's. The target dose is weight-based at 1.5 milligrams per kilo for 6-MP and 2.5 milligrams per kilo for azathioprine. These drugs take about 3 to 4 months to become clinically effective, so that's why they're not good induction therapy, and usually we overlap them with another therapy such as a steroid taper, which will put the patient into remission while the immunomodulator is becoming effective, and then the immunomodulator is used for long-term remission. The adverse effects of the thiopurines include bone marrow suppression with neutropenia and rarely agranulocytosis. There is an increased risk of agranulocytosis in patients who have reduced TPMT levels. So some guidelines, especially in the US, recommend monitoring TPMT levels at baseline to detect which patients are at increased risk for this side effect. In the absence of TPMT assays, you need to monitor the CBC closely while initiating therapy and increasing the dose. Some idiosyncratic effects, such as pancreatitis, can be seen with azathioprine and 6-MP, and if this develops, the patient can never go back on these medications. Blood work also needs to be done to monitor for liver enzyme elevations, specifically the AST and ALT. These are immunosuppressive drugs, so just as with steroids, there is an increased risk of infection. And we are becoming more aware of an increased risk of lymphoma in patients with thiopurine use. This increases the risk from a baseline of 2 in 10,000 to 4 in 10,000. So although it is an increased risk, the overall absolute chance of developing lymphoma is still low. The other option for immunomodulator therapy is methotrexate. This has been shown to be effective in Crohn's disease, but has no role in ulcerative colitis. So for Crohn's disease, it is an alternate maintenance therapy, and remission rates in about the 40% range have been documented with this drug. Similar to azathioprine, it takes 3 to 4 months to become effective, so is not useful to induce a remission. And it is administered either by intramuscular or subcutaneous injection on a weekly basis. The adverse effects to be monitored with methotrexate include nausea and vomiting, hepatic fibrosis, hypersensitivity pneumonitis, and leukopenia. And you cannot forget that methotrexate is teratogenic and cannot be used in women of childbearing age. So in conclusion, our therapeutic options for a patient with ulcerative colitis, generally 5-ASAs are the mainstay of therapy for both induction and maintenance, with steroid induction if 5-ASAs fail or if the disease is severe at the outset, and maintenance therapy with thiopurines if the 5-ASA is not effective maintenance therapy. For Crohn's disease, the 5-ASAs are not particularly useful, so steroid induction is usually the mainstay, and then maintenance therapy with thiopurines or methotrexate. If the thiopurines or methotrexate fail, then the next step up is to biologic therapy, and we'll discuss that in the next podcast.
That's it for episode 2 in our series on inflammatory bowel disease. Next week, we'll be looking at biological agents in the treatment of the disease. Please visit us at surgery101.org, follow our blog, send us an email at surgerypodcast@gmail.com, like us on Facebook, send us a tweet, buy the Surgery 101 app, subscribe to Surgery 101 Notes. Those are all ways that you can help support us and help us keep making great new Surgery 101 episodes. See you over at surgery101.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.